literary meaning. Excited by the success of this new and very social medium, Brand was sucked in and burned. He discovered that the well had a darker side too. Flame wars, trolling, cyberbullying, all the social media dysfunction that is so familiar today came as a disturbing shock in the mid-80s. Larry Brilliant. I knew Stuart Brand from the Merry Prankster days and the Hog Farm days. Stuart Brand. It was mainly through the Hog Farm. Larry Brilliant had been there as a kind of resident physician. Ram Dass. He used to be known as Dr. America. The Hog Farm was a hippie commune in Berkeley run by a fellow named Wavy Gravy. Stuart Brand. And I also knew Larry Brilliant by reputation, what he had done suppressing smallpox in India and eliminating it eventually. Ram Dass. It was very exciting stuff. You've got maps with pins of each case, and you go with vaccination needles in jeeps and boats, and you raid villages. It's like a war. Larry Brilliant. By then, my Rolodex was pretty weird. Ram Dass and Wavy Gravy and the head of the smallpox program, UN diplomats, a bunch of rabbis and Catholic priests with eclectic backgrounds, and Steve Jobs. Ram Dass. When it was over, they all got depressed. They didn't know what to do next. Larry Brilliant. So Steve comes back from India. He starts Apple with Woz. I went back and finally got a degree in public health. Ram Dass. Larry decided he'd start a foundation and get all of his buddies together, and he drew his buddies from all the different parts of his life. Larry Brilliant. And often Steve would call me. I remember once I was in the middle of painting my fence in Michigan, and my wife says, "Steve's on the line." I rush to the phone, covered with paint, and he says, "Larry, I understand you're thinking of starting a new organization." Ram Dass. The organization he called SEVA, which meant Society for Epidemiological Voluntary Assistance, only he knew that it was also the Sanskrit word for service. Ram Dass. And I said, "Yes, we decided we would tackle blindness. We've got money from the Dutch government to do it in Nepal, and we want to start it off with a survey. We want to do it the right way. Hippies we might have been, but we were scientific hippies." Lee Felsenstein. You could say you were a hippie and didn't like technology, but what Whole Earth was telling us all, and we all believed, was that you were going to be using technology if you are a human. And so, as Stuart said, we'd best get good at it. Larry Brilliant. And so Steve said, "Larry, I have just the thing for you. And are you ready for this? I know the software that you can use to run your survey. It's called VisiCalc. It's an electronic spreadsheet." To which I said, "What's a spreadsheet?" And so we talked for about 2 hours. And finally this package arrives and we smuggled it into Nepal. This was the Apple II, serial number 12. They said, "What is it?" And I said, "It's a typewriter." And they said, "No problem, go in." So I had that. I had one of the first acoustic modems, and I had all sorts of crazy software that Steve had sent me. And on the last day of the survey, after we'd finished the last case, the helicopter crashed, and it crashed in a town which was just impossible to get to. Nobody was hurt. They say it came down like an oak leaf, but the engine was totally destroyed. It had digested itself. So now I'm running a UN program. I'm a UN officer. My helicopter is down. So how do you get it out? Who pays for it? It had all the hallmarks of the dozens of other planes and helicopters that have crashed in Nepal and that are still there 30 or 40 years later. But I was determined to get it out, and so I thumbed through all the pieces of software that Steve had given me, and one of them was satellite access. So I put it into the Apple II, and managed to access the University of Michigan computer from Kathmandu. And I set up a computer conference call. This became known as computer conferencing. And it included Senator Hatfield's office, the Evergreen Helicopter Office in Oregon, the SEVA office in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the ambassador to India in New Delhi, the UN office in New York, and Aerospace Seattle's office in Paris. Kevin Kelly. This was the dawn of bulletin board systems. Larry Brilliant. There was no email, remember? Howard Rheingold. On a BBS, there was one thread, and you had to wait for the person who was online to get offline so that you could log in. Larry Brilliant. And using store and forward synchronous communications, we were able to get the engine, which weighed maybe a couple of tons, flown in. We put it on the back of a Jeep and rode it through the jungle to the downed helicopter, where we had three or four men acting as a hoist. We changed the engine and flew the helicopter out. That was 1979 or 1980. It was pretty cool. I'd never seen anything like that before. I'd never seen anything happen like that in the UN where a broken helicopter could be repaired and flown out 72 hours later. So a reporter from Byte magazine who heard about it called me and did a story in Byte about computer conferencing. And then I used that when I got back to Michigan to create something we used to call DEO, Distributed Electronic Office. This is 1980-1981. Kevin Kelly. When I got a modem in the early 80s, it was a big aha moment for me because I started to explore bulletin boards in the evening and there was something happening, something really important happening. It was different than anything else I encountered. Something odd was happening there. There was this tone of voice. I mean, there was this sensibility and people were talking in an informed way about stuff that they were interested in. There was this sort of underground aspect to it. There was this community aspect to it. I was an old hippie and was very suspicious of technology. I owned a bicycle. I didn't have a car. I didn't really own anything. I was sort of not so interested in what we called technology, which is like cars and factories. That's what technology was. What I saw when I plugged the computer into the modem was a much more organic version of technology. It was much more Amish-like. It seemed more appropriate. It seemed humane. There was something very robust and biological about it. And Stewart noticed that, too. Larry Brilliant. And then Steve Jobs happened to come to Ann Arbor. He stayed with me, and he had given me the first $5,000 to start SIVA, and I started to hit him up for some money to analyze the data from the survey, and he said, "Well, show me what you've done." And I showed him SIVA Talk. And I showed him how we could talk to each other all over the country. And then when I asked him for the money, he said, "Look, Larry, instead of asking me for money, why don't you take your own fucking software, make your own fucking company, make your own fucking money, endow your own fucking NGO, and get rid of blindness yourself. I'll help you. I'll help you build what you've got into a company and find you investors to take it public." And he did. And that's what happened. Ram Dass. The company he started was a software computer company. What it does is set up conferencing through computers. The first beta test site was the SIVA Foundation. Kevin Kelly. Larry is a very entrepreneurial guy. Ram Dass. The stock of the NETI Corporation endowed the SIVA Foundation. Larry Brilliant. Then I said, "Stuart, I took this company public. I have some money. How about we do a joint venture? This is how The Well got started." Stuart Brand. Larry wanted a whole earth catalog teleconference of some sort, basically an online version of the whole earth catalog. He was a lover of the whole earth catalog, I guess. Fabrice Florin. The counterculture movement idolized the whole earth catalog, which symbolized this kind of holistic view of the world. Stuart Brand. I said, "I'd be interested in working on that. What do we get?" Larry Brilliant. I said, "I'll give you some technology and a couple hundred grand, and you provide the customer base, the family, the community. You run it, and we split it 50-50. Kevin Kelly. So we started The Well in 1985. Fabrice Florin. The Well stood for Whole Earth Electronic Link. Stuart Brand. I had seen online teleconferencing, and I had seen things that had made it wonderful and things that had made it terrible. And there were also bulletin board systems around at that time, which had also established a certain amount of behaviors that were wonderful and not so wonderful. So based on those experiences, we designed what became called the Well to reflect what had been learned about online discussions at that point. Kevin Kelly. What Whole Earth wanted to do was to try out the experiment of what happens if you open this up to ordinary people. How does it all work? No one had really opened this up to the public beyond what CompuServe and Prodigy were doing. Very controlled, minimalist systems. Fabrice Florin. Stuart Brand recognized very early on the importance of computers for information sharing, and so very early on he wanted to be able to serve his community with the right tools that would allow people to communicate and share ideas effectively. Kevin Kelly. Whether it was ever articulated or not, what Whole Earth was doing was trying to make it work in terms of governance, best practices, cultural nudges, pricing. Howard Rheingold. Part of it was not trying to shape it, enabling the shape to emerge, letting the people there make whatever it was. Kevin Kelly. One of the design principles for the Well was to try to get as close to free as we could get. The idea was to see how cheap can we possibly make this, cheap for the user. Stuart Brand. I priced it to be very inviting. Kevin Kelly. We would bring the power to the people by having really cheap telecommunications. And that, I think, in some ways, that idea came from the hacker community, the Hackers Conference. Stuart Brand. We made it easy to make conferences, and people would invent conferences. Anybody could start a conference. Kevin Kelly. It was kind of a hack. The software was buggy, but sort of open and easy to modify. Lee Felsenstein. All the people who had been at the Hackers Conference were offered memberships. Stuart Brand. I wanted hackers inside the system, so we invited them in, and writers, journalists, all got free accounts. And that was our marketing. Initially, it was just sort of friends of the Whole Earth catalog. Larry Brilliant. Ram Dass was on the Well, Wavy Gravy was on the Well, all the Siva people started using the Well. It was pretty cute. Howard Rheingold. Stuart Brand brought together the environmental network, the people who were interested in community, self-sufficiency, communes, personal computers, tools. So it was really the meeting of those communities and this kind of ongoing party. Larry Brilliant. And then the Deadheads started sharing audio tapes. They were digitized and available online, but the only way you could find the location online was to do it through the Well. Kevin Kelly. And once they would come into the Deadhead conferences, they would spill over. They would say, oh, you have a thread on gardening, wow. Or a thread on parenting, whatever. So they would come on to swap playlists, and then they would go on to discover the rest of the world and become some of the most active contributors. Fred Davis. It was like a hip pre-Craigslist thing where you'd hear about where a secret rave would be or who had tickets to the Dead concert or whatever. There was a real community, a cyber culture community. Michael Nymark. You couldn't even send a picture on the Well. It was text only, and of course it was asynchronous. There was no live chat, but nevertheless, a lot of us were on the Well, if not hourly, then multiple times a day. After Atari collapsed, Brenda and I were putting together some grand plan for virtual reality. We were striving to make virtual reality experiences that felt just like being there. But the irony was that this little trickle of text that wasn't even live gave us the greatest feeling of liveness. It felt more live than any VR stuff we could possibly do. Howard Rheingold. And it was all just words on a screen. Are you serious? These were just text-based bulletin boards, but in many ways they were superior to social media today. You had really great conversations with extraordinary people. Larry Brilliant. Because it was Stuart, he attracted people who had these incredibly eclectic minds. And they were phenomenal writers, people who think in paragraphs. And the writing was fantastic. Kevin Kelly. That made for a very literate salon-like environment where people who could write were writing, and writing well, and writing very directly. So some of the best writing, I think, of that decade was happening on the well. Larry Brilliant. So just the opposite of Twitter. Lee Felsenstein. The well, for its first 5 years at least, was the San Francisco bohemian scene online where you could join the roundtable of whatever it was. There was a whole bunch of roundtables. And in there were the people who were the ones you had read about and so forth, or had first-hand connections with the people you read about. San Francisco had had such a scene since the 19th century, and here it came direct to your home at your fingertips. Howard Rheingold. It was like there was a party happening in the walls of your house. You know, people were talking about serious things and exchanging knowledge, but they were also having fun. Kevin Kelly. Stuart and I, we were living on the well. This was the beauty of it. Lee Felsenstein. It was an experiment, an attempt to infuse their culture into an online system. They were feeling their way, as anybody would have to, since it really hadn't been done before. Kevin Kelly. I can't remember what the first conference was, but very quickly there was a conference about the well itself, because we quickly learned that talking about the well and the policies of the well would kind of creep up in every single discussion. Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that? Because nobody knew anything. We didn't even know we needed moderators. That was not even clear. That was not something we thought about before. Why do you need moderators? Lee Felsenstein. They assigned me to moderate the hackers section of it. Kevin Kelly. That became one of the biggest jobs that we had, people having to moderate the conversation. Lee Felsenstein. And so I had to bust up some kind of paranoid discussion threads that mostly had to do with other personalities in the conference. A couple of times I had to jump in and say, now you are all making far too much out of this. There's nothing there. And, you know, calm down, for God's sake. It was worth the effort, but it took effort. Kevin Kelly. These systems are natural amplifiers, and negative things are somehow easier to amplify or become much louder than positive things. There's something about a negative amplification that just powers up. And so we saw these phenomena where small slights would be amplified into huge harm and pilings on, and people who were normally very civil would get sucked up into battles, and they would have what we call flame wars. It was sort of like a flame in the sense that the hotter it got, the more that would be sucked into it and burn. Lee Felsenstein. We discovered early on about the tendency to flame. Hackers do that, of course, but we thought that was just a hacker thing, and it turned out not to be. Kevin Kelly. And we began to see trolls, although we didn't use that term at the time, where there were people who were getting satisfaction out of starting fires or nudging people. They would do that over and over again just because they liked to see what would happen. Stuart Brand. People learned how to deal with trolls. If you respond to them, they will make the flame even brighter. Kevin Kelly. So we had to deal with that, and issues about people wanting to remove what they had said, and whether that was okay. And so there were all these things that are now very familiar dynamics that were completely new to us. And each one we had to address, and we were spending days and nights and evenings trying to manage these things. Howard Rheingold. The well had a policy that people should be who they are, and so you had to use a credit card or otherwise go to the office and show some ID to prove who you were. That was a good design decision. Stuart Brand. I had seen a situation online where people behaved very, very badly, and I knew that even famous intellectuals would behave badly to each other if they were able to post anonymously. Based on that, I made it impossible to be anonymous on the well. However, you could put on a handle, which would be sort of pseudo-anonymous. Kevin Kelly. We did have an anonymous conference. That was a true experiment, and that was driven much more from the users who said, "Can we have an anonymous conference?" And we said, "Okay." We had no idea what would happen. Sometimes completely amazing stuff would occur in the anonymous conference, but in other cases, this could be kind of scary and weird and creepy. People would confess to things or do stuff. Stuart Brand. The anonymous conference was easy to set up with that software, and it lasted less than a week, because people immediately behaved absolutely viciously to each other. They pretended to be each other. They thought they were just spoofing, but actually it was mortally insulting stuff they were doing. Kevin Kelly. We were asking ourselves, what do we do about this? Are we legally liable? And again, that's the kind of stuff that, at the board level, I was concerned with. I didn't have an opinion about anonymity before the anonymous conference, but after the anonymous conference, I had an opinion. It was not good. Stuart Brand. So the well kind of grew and got a life of its own and established a certain amount of online practice. Howard Rheingold. There was kind of a social policy. You own your own words was mostly about people had to get permission if they were going to quote you. But it was also about taking responsibility for your words. Larry Brilliant. And the reason that the well succeeded was because of those things. Not because of the software. Not because of the money. Kevin Kelly. It was all new territory, and it was very formative, because there's very little that's happened since that wasn't present in the decade that the well was running at its height. Almost all the things that we've now come to see as a marked characteristic of this time emerged then, and we were dealing with it for the first time. Howard Rheingold. And in some ways, it was a forecast of not just the best of what online community could offer, but also the worst. You know, people who just like to snipe at you. Kevin Kelly. This was years into it, but at one point Stuart basically quit the well, because as the leader of this enterprise, he really wasn't the leader, but as the figurehead, he was just getting trolled. He was getting pounded and harassed, and it was no fun, and so he thought, "No fun? I'm out of here." Howard Rheingold. Stuart got irritated, and who can blame him? He created the place. A lot of anti-authoritarianism was projected on Stuart because he was Stuart. Stuart Brand. There was a classic kind of gang-up thing that one continues to see occasionally, and I just bailed at that point. Howard Rheingold. It's very difficult to get thrown out of the well, especially for being an asshole. They have to argue about it for months. A lot of people, including myself, just sort of got sick of it. Stuart Brand. In any community, new people show up, and they want to participate. And the old hands typically close ranks and sneer at the newbies. I should have known that would happen at the well. We should have made it the case where part of your job as a member of the well was to make new people feel welcome. We never did that. It was a part of what kept the well from growing. Kevin Kelly. After Stuart left, everything started to kind of get really big. This was the era of ISPs, and you had Pipeline and Echo and AOL, and it was clear that this was going to stick around. Some of them were growing fast. And so why can't we grow fast? The problem was we were a non-profit. Who's going to invest into this non-profit? And so that was the issue. I looked at it in different ways. Do we want to sell it? Do we want to turn commercial? What's the point of that? So in the end it was like, no, I think we can be more useful being who we are. We could grow and we could make a lot of money. But a lot of people are going to do that. And that might have been the wrong decision, or the right decision to make. But it was my decision to keep it sort of experimental. Stuart Brand. It was never a commercial success. It may have paid its own way just barely. What could be tried with this medium? That was the thing. Kevin Kelly. Eventually, it was sold to Salon, but it was really too late at that point. Stuart Brand. It had great continuity, and those people stayed in touch online for decades and all that. But it ossified. Fabrice Florin. And a lot of the intellectuals that were sharing ideas on the well went on to branch out into different areas. But you can really trace back a lot of the origins of this new movement to the well. A lot of the folks were there. Howard Rheingold. I remember I got a friend request on Facebook early from Steve Case, and I said, I know who you are, but why do you want to friend me? And he said, oh, I lurked on the well from the beginning. So I think, yes, it did influence things. Larry Brilliant. Steve Jobs was on it. Steve had a fake name, and he lurked. Howard Rheingold. Steve Jobs, Steve Case, Craig Newmark, they would all say they were informed by their experiences on the well. Fabrice Florin, the well was the birthplace of the online community. Larry Brilliant, all that goes back to Steve giving me the computer, letting me use it in Nepal, the experience I had with his software to access the satellite. And then coming back and Steve seeing what Siva Talk could be. We showed it to hundreds of people and nobody saw anything in it. Steve got it immediately. Fabrice Florin. And Stuart basically gave the technology a set of values and ethics that all the developers could share. They already had their own hacker ethic, but he helped to amplify it and bring people together. Then it became big business. And it was hard for intellectuals to be the primary driving force anymore. It became the business people who started driving it, which is understandable given the scale and scope of what happened. It just became too large for intellectuals to hold. Reality check. The new thing that wasn't. Virtual reality is Silicon Valley's next new thing. Facebook and Google, not to mention Microsoft, are making huge bets on the technology and battling to control its future. Hollywood has jumped on the bandwagon, too. The best VR content is now showcased every year at the Sundance Film Festival. But VR is not as new as it seems. It germinated inside Alan Kay's research lab at Atari. The lab collapsed when Atari did, scattering Kay's people across the valley, but a young, dreadlocked programming prodigy, Jaron Lanier, continued the research on his own dime. His original goal was to revive an old dream. Like Doug Engelbart and Alan Kay, Lanier wanted to create a computing environment that was immersive, flexible, and empowering. The difference was the interface. Engelbart invented the mouse. Alan Kay added the desktop metaphor. And in Lanier's iteration, one donned goggles and gloves and stepped into virtual reality. Lanier actually coined the phrase, and the whole point of this new all-enveloping interface was to be able to program the computer from the inside. There was just one problem. Once people got inside the computer, virtually no one wanted to code. There was a whole world in there, a cyberdelic Disneyland, just waiting to be explored. Lanier thought he was building a next-generation programming language with the corresponding next-generation graphical user interface. But what people experienced was something a lot more fun. VR was the well's cyberspace made real. Taking advantage of the ensuing limelight, Lanier swiftly assumed a more Jobs-like role, and marketed the heck out of his virtual reality machine. But in the end, the cost of an e-ticket was just too high. Jaron Lanier. I had already been working on virtual reality stuff in garages in Palo Alto before I went to do the Atari Cambridge thing. We did all kinds of weird experiments, all very funky and all short-lived. Tom came up to me after one of my talks in the early 80s. Tom Zimmerman. I met Jaron at a Stanford electronic music concert at night in the outdoors, and I told him I had this glove. Jaron Lanier. I said, oh, what does it do? And he says, well, it's got continuous sensors. Oh, my God, we have to talk. Tom Zimmerman. I had invented the data glove between graduating MIT and joining Atari Labs. Jaron Lanier. There were a lot of people who had done sensor gloves of one sort or another for, like, hearing-impaired applications or different things, but nobody had actually made a glove, to my knowledge, that had continuous sensing before. And so lightning fast, I introduced him to a bunch of the other people who were kind of in the circle, including young Harville and his wife Anne Lasko. Young Harville. Jaron had a house with Daniel Kottke, and we rented a house across the street from Jaron. Dan Kottke. Jaron was a lean and trim game programmer when I met him. Young Harville. He was finishing a game called Moondust that was for the Commodore 64. It was a success, and he did well with it. Tom Zimmerman. What was cool about Moondust was it was probably one of the first non-violent games, and the goal was just to create a visual, acoustical orgy of eye candy and sound, which was kind of a nice goal. It was this game where you were a little spacecraft, and there's, like, dust, and you have to surround the dust and corral it. And then it just, like, explodes. So I think that spoke well of Jaron and his life-affirming nature. David Levitt. Zimmerman may have introduced Jaron and I. We had all this overlap in our interests with music. We resonated. We had a lot of the same ideas. People called us the twins because I had dreadlocks then, too. Jaron Lanier. So, about my hair. I gave up combing it at a certain point because it was taking over my life, and so I basically had three options. I either would spend all my life on hair care, I'd shave it off, or I'd just let it do what it wanted. And I just felt that of those options, the laziest was the one I chose. Young Harville. Anyway, he was just coming off finishing this game. Howard Rheingold. There was the personal computer, and video games were a big cultural splash. And so, at the time, people were beginning to ask, what's the next thing? Because things at that time seemed to be happening quickly. Although, at the time, I don't think there was any talk of virtual reality. Jaron Lanier. Dan Kottke would kind of bring pre-release Macs home, wrapped in towels on the back of his motorcycle. And things would happen. The first MIDI program that I'm aware of was made on a pre-release Mac that Dan had snuck out of Apple. Dan Kottke. I did that MIDI interface. It seemed like an exciting thing. Tom Zimmerman. And then Jaron started getting into this programming language idea. Jaron Lanier. I had a lot of money come in 83 because this one game of mine called Moondust was quite successful. Tom Zimmerman. And Atari blew up, so at some point Jaron said, I'm forming this new company, why don't you join me? This was a lot more exciting to me, because it centered around making the glove that I had been developing for a while. And so I joined him, and that was the start of VPL. Jaron Lanier. I believe VPL was incorporated in 83. Young Harville. VPL originally stood for Visual Programming Language. Tom Zimmerman. Jaron was developing a programming language. He really wanted to go for it. Jaron Lanier. Back then we had the freedom to think in the big picture, which very few people have now. So the way people thought is they started with a general philosophy of life and tried to turn that into a computational paradigm. And then thought about software architecture and hardware interfaces as part of the same unified concept. So that's exactly what Doug Engelbart did with his Augment system. And it's exactly what Alan Kay was doing with his systems. Smalltalk and the familiar interface and computer came about as one thing. And there were many other examples. So this is the way we all did it back then. Young Harville. Jaron's idea was that you could have a visual language. Kids could choose a series of actions that were represented by pictures, watch what they did by individually triggering them, and then collect them in a little order. And then that would become essentially a subroutine represented by this new picture that you made, then that would become another one of these items that you could then demonstrate how it worked. Tom Zimmerman. Jaren saw the glove as an input device for his programming language. Young Harville. What Jaren was pushing for, and Tom, I think, also, was for gestural interface rather than just click and drag and place. The visual language that you get with a mouse and a keyboard is limited. If you wanted to have a visual type input, or say you wanted to have more analog-like input to trigger music or bend notes, then the gestural interface was really important, and so that was his whole point with the glove and gestures. David Levitt. It's a direct manipulation interface. Young Harville. Jaren was very interested in Coco the Gorilla and the whole gestural thing. We were interested in sign language as just a beautiful gestural language. So I think at some point Jaren felt that this was a way to go after the whole Engelbart thing in terms of just pure expression. And everyone knew what the guys at Xerox PARC did and what they put together and how far they pushed that system. It was a touchstone. Jaren Lanier. I was really interested in systems where you could change them while you're using them without limitation. Young Harville. So the first thing I ended up doing for VPL was the output for the optical glove that Tom was working on at the time. Jaren Lanier. We very quickly added a tracker to it so we knew where it was in space and integrated it with some of the software we already had so you could pick up stuff. And it clicked beautifully. I know it ran. I mean, I have a picture of it running on a really early Macintosh. So the glove was already running and interfaced in 84. Glove-based interactions were very hard because the machines were so slow back then. So it required heroic programming, which was in those days mostly supplied by Andy Hertzfeld on the sly. Andy Hertzfeld. I have zero interest in talking about VPL or Jaren. Alan Kay. Jaren's first version of VPL was certainly the best demo of anything I'd ever seen on a micro. It was just fantastic in every way. A programming tour de force with four or five really great ideas in it about how you might think about programming, particularly for younger kids. Dan Ingalls. It definitely had this feeling of being able to do drag and drop in a 3D virtual world. There is a lot that can be done in programming using essentially drag and drop. You can drag properties out of a parts bin and drop them on objects, and then the objects take on those properties. David Levitt. The glory of programming this way was that by linking the graphic objects together and saying, this one has that strength, this one has this weight, you could make gravity collisions. You could make a whole game. And if you drew it in front of a kid, they would get every step. It was just miraculous. They understood this as programming inside a video game, rather than about a video game in some external text language. Alan Kay. And it was just great. And of course it used a very, very simple glove he had. And I loved it. So, as a byproduct of building this novel programming language, Lanier had the beginnings of a virtual world. It was, essentially, a 3D version of the graphical user interface pioneered at PARC. Instead of a mouse, there was a glove. Instead of a two-dimensional desktop, there was a three-dimensional workspace. Yet Lanier's virtual world was still trapped on the other side of a screen. It was another Atari research alumnus, Scott Fisher, who took the final step, the leap into cyberspace itself. Brenda Laurel. Scott Fisher, who was part of the proto-VR scene at Atari, went on to NASA Ames and really put the first systems together. Scott Fisher. God, after I was fired from Atari, it must have taken like 9 months to do the background checks. But by the beginning of 85, I'm at NASA. I was also really passionate and obsessed with this idea of getting these head-mounted displays put together. And within the first week, I discovered that they have already put together this really great display. Tom Zimmerman. So Scott had a head-mounted display at NASA. Jaron Lanier. It was a very, very low-res display. So basically, each pixel was as big as, like, a kitchen tile or something. But it had a head tracker, and it was reasonably fast, and you could see fairly detailed things in it. Scott Fisher. It had, like, I think, 100 by 100 resolution. Brenda Laurel. It was just green vector graphics on a black background. Tom Zimmerman. Scott's vision was an astronaut could manipulate things outside of the capsule while being inside the capsule. Sort of like what they now have with the shuttle arm. Scott Fisher. So I tracked down Tom, and he by then had hooked up with Jaron to do VPL, and they were trying to figure out how to use the glove for this visual programming language that Jaron wanted to do. And I'm like, well, can you guys build a glove for us? Because I needed a way to reach into that space and touch these virtual objects. Tom Zimmerman. So Scott Fisher did telerobotics while Jaron was talking about synthesized worlds, and he came to us with that vision and then contracted us to make a glove to do that. Scott Fisher. We spent a lot of time with Tom and Chuck Blanchard, who did most of the software. He was from VPL. He helped us interface it with our system and wrote some great code to make that work. We ended up getting another glove so we could have two hands. And Tom continued to work on the glove technology, so it was getting better and better. Tom Zimmerman. It was kind of the industrial use of virtual reality. Brenda Laurel. They were doing training. I can remember laughing because one of their demos had a pull-down menu, and it was like, why the fuck would you go to so much trouble to model a real world and then put a pull-down menu in it? It's just like using a speech interface to say, move arrow on my screen. It was dumb, but I could immediately see the possibilities. Jaron Lanier. It taught me how VR worked. It made a huge impact on me. Tom Zimmerman. So Scott gave us entree into matching the gloves with the head-mounted display. So that was a crucial element. Jaron Lanier. Then we developed our own head-mounted display. David Levitt. Our hardware engineer took apart a sharper image TV, a little Sony TV that was relatively uncommon in those days, and reverse-engineered until we found the video signal and said, yes, we can make a silicon graphics machine drive that. Jim Clark. Silicon Graphics was a company that primarily made what would now be called GPUs, Special Purpose Graphics Processing Units, to accelerate graphics so that people who used our equipment could visualize the models that they made. David Levitt. We used two Silicon Graphics machines, one for each eye, of course. So that became the first iPhone. Jaron Lanier. iPhone, E-Y-E, obviously. Mitch Altman. Our resolution was super low, 480 by 680. Jaron Lanier. And the iPhone was the first commercially available head-mounted display. We sold a lot to labs all over the world. Scott Fisher. I made it very clear in talks that I gave and talking with our collaborators like VPL that our next big push at NASA was for a multi-user system, having multiple people in the shared virtual space. Jaron Lanier. The whole thing of being in there with other people where each person becomes an avatar was super important. That was the whole point. Tom Zimmerman. And so what Jaron did was he took the head-mounted display, which was done by Scott Fisher at NASA, and he now created this whole interactive virtual world, where he was really emphasizing interaction between humans in this synthetic world. Scott Fisher. And next thing I know, VPL has put out press releases saying that they've done it. It was competitive, and I hadn't been thinking of it as competitive. So, again, I guess I was kind of naive about that. Tom Zimmerman. There might be some jealousy because Jaron definitely got 95% of the media attention. David Levitt. Our lead product at VPL was called Reality Built for Two, RB2. That was an SKU at VPL. Jaron Lanier. This is actually a bit of an inside joke, and it goes back to Alan Kay. So Alan Kay had once called a computer a bicycle for the mind. And, in fact, Steve Jobs put that slogan on some of the early Apple literature. So I thought the idea of it being a reality built for two recalled bicycles. Alan Kay. A lot of this stuff is just modern engineering versions of old ideas. Ivan Sutherland did it first. Jim Clark. Ivan had created a head-mounted display in 1968. I had the idea that one ought to be able to work in a three-dimensional environment doing three-dimensional design, making all that work and putting it together as a system, and doing the mathematics to make the curves and all of that was essentially my PhD thesis. It was the first early beginnings of being in 3D. Tom Zimmerman. Jaron really took the idea and ran with it and did a great job of marketing. Jaron used to say we were the haberdashers of virtual reality. Jim Clark. I kind of resented Jaron Lanier for coining that term virtual reality, but he is a very smart guy. He is not a technology guy particularly. Jaron Lanier. See, we didn't make the first head-mounted display, but we did make the first commercial one, and the requirements for a reproducible one were totally different. So we had to be able to make them on an assembly line. That was all us. Tom Zimmerman. So when we started, Jaron saw the glove as an input device for his programming language, and the message we got pretty quickly was no one wants to program, but the glove is cool. So we had a glove. We had a pretty powerful new paradigm of being in the simulation. So we were a hammer looking for nails. We were capabilities looking for applications. And it turns out entertainment was the killer app and probably still is. Kevin Kelly. I don't remember how I connected with Jaron. Maybe I was the first, but I somehow wound up at VPL with Jaron in 88. I came down to try out his goggles and gloves setup. This was pretty early on, so there wasn't a lot of other people interested in this. I got to try on this thing and entered in a world that Jaron had just made that afternoon that he hadn't even explored. And it was pretty amazing. It was just like, wow, this is amazing. I thought that it was the beginning of something really big immediately. I could see it. Jamie Zawinski. I was working at Berkeley in the AI group there, and somehow we got an invite. Yeah, waited in line, put the helmet on, got to play around. It was running on SGI Indigos or something. It's like, oh, I can reach out, and I can grab the diamond, and then it turns into a rose. Wow, that's so cool. I probably got to wear the thing for maybe a couple of minutes, but it was amazing. It was so cool. Jameis McNiven. You'd put the headgear on and a glove, and then you sort of walk out into virtual space, and you just drift through the room. It was all very geometric, but you felt as if you went out of your body drifting, and the glove would be the way you would direct it. I think you saw a little icon of a glove that was your hand. David Levitt. To move in the world, you needed navigation. The standard way was to let the data glove be your controller and to point in the direction that you wanted to go and click your thumb to accelerate. Jameis McNiven. And you drift around corners and down streets and you felt like you had gone into the Matrix. David Levitt.
I wound up being one of the big people demoing people in it and expanding and improving the demos over time.
I experimented with gravity and I made it sideways. I set it up so that any time I closed my hand, a ball would appear, and when I released it would be pulled by gravity, but horizontally, so it would bounce off a wall and then come back to me. Jaron Lanier. David Levitt was the first person to fall asleep in VR, and then woke up inside VR, which is this amazing thing. David Levitt. And waking up to that could not have felt more alien. Oh my God, gravity is sideways. It was just too much. Kevin Kelly. And it was very fun. Kind of surprisingly fun to just explore a fantastical world with nonsense entities and creatures and stuff. And so the thrill is probably closest to visiting a really weird temple in Kathmandu. It's sort of exotic in that sense. It's strange. And you are also aware that this is all happening in your living room or whatever. And that's kind of exciting too. And of course, Jaron has got his whole philosophy and he's going on and on. Jaron Lanier. Post-symbolic communication, yeah. I used to go on and on about that stuff. Kevin Kelly. I didn't understand anything he was saying. Tom Zimmerman. Then young Harville and young's wife Anne started working on these bodysuits instrumenting the whole body. David Levitt. People, of course, like new technology, and they quickly said, what are the sexual possibilities? Howard Rheingold. A lot of it was, okay, we're going to have sex at a distance through computers somehow. David Levitt. The term teledildonics quickly became common. Howard Rheingold. I got so much weird attention for that one word. There were, I'll tell you, journalists from all over the world wanted to talk about teledildonics for a little while. It was part of this cyberculture vision, the Mondo 2000 vision. Jaron Lanier. There was a tremendous pressure from the cultural underground. Oh, I am super cool. I published the underground magazine from Amsterdam, and I know Tim Leary. It was, I did this and that, and I'm the coolest, and you have to give me a demo. There were a lot of people like that. Scott Fisher. When VR got into popular culture and the media went crazy, I felt that it was kind of over at that point. Jaron Lanier. They were really wild times back then. I mean, there was a flow of celebrities into the place. My personal assistant would be like, the Dalai Lama is stuck in traffic. Go ahead with Leonard Bernstein. It's okay. David Levitt. We demoed for Spinal Tap. Jaron Lanier. I remember Spinal Tap showing up. There was this big fuss. I was like, why do we want to show it to Spinal Tap? Then some of the engineers said, oh, come on, you have to let Spinal Tap in. David Levitt. We made a tiny virtual Stonehenge in honor of their movie. Jaron Lanier. I said, you know, if you use the wigs, they'll just get messed up by the head mounts. And they said, fine. Jaron Lanier. And that was like a day at work at VPL, just kind of completely insane. Young Harville. I remember being worried about the hype. You know that inevitably in pretty much every technology, it reaches this point where people really get what it could possibly do, and then they just kind of spin creatively on. Then they kind of convince themselves it's kind of already there. That's a really dangerous phase for any technology. Scott Fisher. People started saying that VR was dead or it was never going to go anywhere. Kevin Kelly. Why did it not take off? I certainly expected it to take off. I think it's not just that it was the collapse of the hype. Jaron Lanier. My worst mistake with VPL was the business model. The problem was that there's not that many labs, ultimately. After maybe a couple of thousand customers in the world, you run out. And it gets hard to come up with something so dramatic for the next generation machine that you get them to spend the money again. And so at that point, all you can do is either try to go down in price point to sell something to larger numbers of customers, or turn into a military contractor. David Levitt. So the RB2 system, the reality built for two, included a Mac as the main control and one or more Silicon graphics machines. In those days, it was hard to get the performance you needed without a separate silicon graphics machine for each eye. So that got expensive. Mitch Altman. RB2 was a $250,000 machine. Not many people could afford it. Jaron Lanier. For the full-on thing, it was about $1 million a person. And there were only a couple thousand customers in the world who could pay $1 million for a VR system. Kevin Kelly. Without Moore's Law, you couldn't take the next step.
You could say the expectation ran ahead of VR.
And that was the fault of the expectation. But actually, I think the expectation was valid. It's just that there was a gap. There was some evolution needed to take place. We went to the moon and then didn't follow up. Jaron Lanier. VPL started to hit a ceiling around 92, which forced the question of what to do next. I wanted to put all available resources into selling Microcosm, which was this amazing product that we developed that never shipped. It was this beautifully sculpted one-piece virtual reality unit that had all the tracking equipment and all the computers and everything. There was a really innovative head-mounted display, sort of like opera glasses, where there was a handle so you can get in and out of it really fast. And then you could wear a glove on the other hand. And it worked beautifully. I thought that we might be able to get that to a price point where we could sell enough of them to start to follow Moore's Law down and sell it to larger and larger volumes and make it to the big time. So that's the path I wanted. The majority of the board wanted to turn into a military contractor, patent as much as possible, hold on to the patents until they were valuable, and then sell them. It's a very reasonable business dispute, so I left, and the company continued on trying to do the other plan. Tom Zimmerman. The problem was that we started spending more money on protecting our patents than on innovating, and that consumed more and more of our resources. It's sad. David Levitt. It was terrible timing because within a year of VPL closing its doors, the PlayStation came out. For $300, you could have replaced our $50,000 per eye silicon graphics machines in 1994. What is so interesting is that no one picked up on that. Had they not noticed that the leader in the field had left it open to them and that the hardware was now affordable, who was going to pick it up? No one did. Michael Nymark. What happened? The spotlight shifted to the internet and the web. Scott Fisher. So my lab at NASA fell apart, and out of that came lots of little companies that really wanted to build pieces of the technology and figure out what the content was and where we could go with it. And for the next decade, some of us did that. Well, the internet stuff went through a similar kind of crazy roller coaster ride. I thank God for the internet because that became the next big meme that took the attention away from VR, which was fine. Because then we could get back to work. Clive Thompson. The weird irony or poetic strangeness about VR is that it was the production of a billion mobile phones with their need for screens and little sensors that could figure out whether you were tilting them or whatnot that created this new generation of hardware. You've got Facebook's Oculus, Google's Cardboard, Microsoft's HoloLens, HTC's Vive, and they're all trying to figure out what this environment is good for. David Levitt. These VR fads come and go. Before VPL ended, I used to think that there is a technological inevitability to VR, that it was unstoppable. After VPL was gone, I realized that it takes a visionary, a Steve Jobs or a Jaron Lanier or an Engelbart determines whether these things are overlooked or not. A true visionary just makes the future out of what is available and does not wait for the technology to catch up with him. Tom Zimmerman. There are three archetypes that are essential for invention. The dreamer, the first person who thinks of an idea, the engineer who reduces the idea to a prototype, and then the entrepreneur who takes that one prototype and works out the marketing, financing, and business model to make thousands or millions of them. Jaron was the entrepreneur. Jaron Lanier. If all a lab needed was a head-mounted display, we would sell them that. If all they needed was a glove, like Scott, we could sell them that. We had all these modules, a spherical video system so we could gather and replay spherical video. We did 3D sound. We really had the complete thing, all in sort of early version.